Welcome to The Green Urbanist, the podcast for urbanists fighting climate change. Today's episode is a conversation with Salim Kunsal. Salim is a sustainability engineer who has worked on projects in the Middle East, Europe, Africa, and the Caribbean. Originally from Amman in Jordan, he moved to England to study civil and environmental engineering and has spent the last 6 years working on exciting international projects. Salim is a good friend of mine. We used to work together in a previous job, and he was actually one of the first people I met when I moved to London a few years ago. And with this episode, I really wanted to bring out important insights and lessons that he's learned about sustainability in general, and more specifically about sustainability in the Middle Eastern context. Being from Jordan himself and having worked on projects in several Middle Eastern countries, he has some important messages about this often misunderstood region. We talk about how the Middle East is not just one place, it's very diverse and complex. We talk about how the region is adapting to the impact of climate change and how modern innovative solutions aren't always the way forward. We also talk about the concept of resilience and how cities around the world can bounce forward to a new equilibrium, a new normal after the COVID-19 pandemic. Salim is now involved in more UK-based work, and if you want to get in contact with him, his email address and his LinkedIn profile are in the episode description. If you enjoy this episode, remember to subscribe or follow the podcast wherever you're listening so you don't miss an episode. I love to get feedback and hear from listeners, so please engage with me on Instagram and Twitter or email me directly at greenurbanistpod@gmail.com. Okay, here is my conversation with Salim Kunsal. Hello, Salim Kunsal. Welcome to the Green Urbanist Podcast.
Hi, Ross. Thanks a lot for having me here. I'm really excited about this.
Be great if you could kick off and just tell us a bit about yourself. What's your background and what is it that you do?
Sure. Yeah. So I was originally trained up in engineering, civil and environmental engineering, doing a degree in that in UCL. And while I was doing this degree, I became very interested in the topic of sustainability, of environmental design, environmental engineering, and did my final year project in this topic when I was still at university. Afterwards, I joined DAR, who I worked with for 6 years up until last week, basically, as a sustainability engineer, and did a part-time MSc in environmental design and engineering, also at the Bartlett in UCL during that time. I also do quite a bit of mentoring, student mentoring for UCL, kind of in the topic of sustainability. And my goal in life is to spread this message of a more sustainable future, of the importance of environmental design and engineering.
That's great. And you grew up in Jordan?
Yeah. So I grew up in Jordan up until I was 16. I came here to a boarding school for a couple of years before joining university. And I think growing up in Jordan, a country with very minimal resources, with very little water, it definitely pushed me towards this career option. It's something that you live with while you're there. You live with the heat, obviously. You live with the, there's never any water shortages, but you live with the news about water shortages potentially happening. And that definitely influenced me a lot to take this career path.
Right. It's not a theoretical thing for you. It's something you just grew up having to deal with.
Yeah, it's a practical thing, yeah.
So I wanted to have you on because of your background and your experience working, obviously living and working in the Middle East. Now, when we, maybe as Westerners, talk about the Middle East, we sort of think of this like very homogenous place that's all just very hot and desert. And just a very like harsh place. Something we've talked about before is that this is, you know, it's actually quite a diverse, complex place that many people don't understand. Could you like get into that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, there is this thought from everywhere around the world that the Middle East is kind of one desert, hot area, no rain, kind of hot all around the year. When in reality, some areas are like this, but it is like you said, it's a very diverse area. I've lived in Jordan, I've lived in Amman, the capital city of Jordan, where it can get very cold during winter. It can snow during winter. It snows once every couple of years, once a year, quite heavily as well. And it's not always cold that's the problem. It's not always heat that's the problem, but it's sometimes actually cold that's also the problem, which is interesting. And then you have certain cities, Riyadh, and for example in Saudi Arabia, which is in the middle of the city, in the middle of the country, it can get very hot. Obviously, it does stay hot during the year, but it can also drop in temperature during winter. You have some cities that are on the coast, and you have a lot of cities on the coast in the Middle East, just to benefit from better temperatures, to benefit from sea passage. Obviously, in those areas, you can have a lot of humidity, which you might not have in other areas. Going back to Amman, Amman's very dry, for example, compared to one of the cities, compared to Doha, which is near the sea, for example. So there's definitely a lot of diversity in terms of the climate. You get to countries like Lebanon, which are completely green, for example. Not many people know that, but you can actually go skiing in Lebanon. They have several ski resorts there, for example. So this idea of it being completely hot, it's you need to always approach that area with a mind that you need to investigate where you're working in, what city you're talking about, because it can be very unique. Every city there can be unique, completely unique compared to the other.
I mean, how does that how do you approach that then as a professional in terms of thinking about the challenges of climate change? You're like, well, obviously we can't just think of it as one problem for the whole area. It obviously needs quite a specific response.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of what we start doing whenever we approach, however many times we've done a project in that country or city, the first thing you always do is look at the climate and try and find historical climate data and try to understand how the climate operates throughout the year. There's different statistical methods to do that, but the gist of it is you're trying to understand how hot it can get during summer on average, how cold it can get during winter, and how often does the temperature go out of the comfort zone of people, whether it's people sitting indoors or outdoors. Obviously, if you're sitting inside your house, your tolerance is much less. If you're going out for a walk, you can tolerate lower temperatures or higher temperatures sometimes. But you don't want your living space to go up that high or low. You look at things like wind, and wind can be actually quite an important thing, especially in the Middle East. During summer, it can be a very big cooling factor if you design and plan properly, but it can also have some negative consequences as a result of it, because it can bring in sand, it can bring in dust, and that's all things that you have to look at. And that's just the very beginning. You're looking at all of these things. As you progress with the design, the most important thing is to also design not against this climate analysis that you formed, but against what you expect it to become in a few years as a result of climate change. So we are already hitting certain temperature rises that we can't stop. And temperature rises are easy to understand, easier to understand, I would say. They're you know how many degrees it's going to go up by. The things that are more tough to understand is how much more often is it going to rain? How less is it going to rain? Are you going to have flash floods? It's the different types of climate change, their effects that you have to worry about.
That's fascinating. And what about in terms of, you mentioned water shortages previously. I mean, what are some places in the region doing to sort of tackle that?
Sure. Yeah, it's there's several big things that are happening. The biggest and easiest thing to do has to do with being efficient with your use of water. I did a project on Jordan while I was at university, investigating how much water is being used, how much energy it takes to pump water around. And I found out that 50% of the water gets lost during transition from one place to another. So you're pumping out a lot of water, and you're losing 50% of it before it goes to the consumers. And if you ask me what's the first step in helping this, it's definitely go and make all these systems more efficient, reduce the losses to zero. That's always the first step with these things. There is a lot of work going on to water reuse. So whether it's rainwater, whether it's wastewater. I mean, we once talked about an example of if you go to the bathroom and you just wash your hands, why does that water have to go to the sewage system? Why can't it be used for flushing, for example? It's not completely dirty water. With a bit of treatment, it can be used for flushing. It can be used for irrigation outside as well. So there's a lot of, it's trying to make use as much as you can of, let's say, 1 meter cube of water. How many processes can you pass it through before it becomes completely unusable? And then you have to drop it into the ground, basically. or try and reuse it all over again, try and treat it and reuse it all over again. These two steps are very important. And then the final step, which some countries have needed to do because of rising populations, because of worsening conditions, is desalination. Mm. And desalination is obviously a very more interesting thing, because it can, with enough energy, it can provide you with a unlimited source of water in some sense, but it is very energy intensive, right, as you can imagine. We talked once as well about the energy intensity and how certain types of desalination can be combined with renewable energy plants, so that you're having water supplied through renewable energy. These plants, unfortunately, mostly work near coastal cities, or you would have to pump, obviously, the water to all other cities. As the way desalination works is it just takes seawater, salt water, and turns it into fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
There are two main types of desalination at the moment, and they can either use one type uses mainly heat energy, while the other one uses mainly electricity. And the advances that have been happening in terms of making these plants more efficient have been amazing. So you, with the one that uses heat energy, for example, what you can do is you can simply place it next to gas power plants or your traditional power plants. Use the waste heat from these plants to power the desalination plants. So that's one idea of kind of having a bit of an industrial symbiosis between energy, kind of the energy sector, and between the water sector. Some other types, reverse osmosis kind of desalination plants, these ones use electricity, so it's much easier for you to plug it into a solar power plant. Luckily for us, in some sense it's a bit lucky, but the countries that suffer from water shortages in the Middle East also have a lot of sunlight, they also have a lot of sun days, so luckily you can benefit a lot from having PV power plants more than at any other place in the world. In Jordan, for example, you have 330 days a year of sunshine, which is amazing, because that means you can benefit a lot from these.
But I guess it is still a kind of a last resort, isn't it? Because it's so, the infrastructure is expensive, there's a high upfront cost, but in somewhere like Israel, which has invested millions into it now, it seems to be the only way they feel like they can get the water they need.
Yeah. I mean, in some instances, it is becoming slowly that there's it is difficult, and that the idea that there's a rising population as well, it doesn't help. You have to supply a lot more water, but it's not just the rising population; it's also the rising industries. There's a lot of industries that use ridiculous amounts of water. In Saudi Arabia, as an example, there's a lot of new factories coming up, heavy industries coming up, and they all need a lot of water as well. And I think that's part of the reason why it's going up so much. It's not so much as a water shortage, but it is a water shortage, but the water amount, its supply is decreasing and it's finishing. Right. But at the same time, the demand for it is increasing so much. A lot of these countries also depend on underground water reservoirs to supply their fresh water. That's obviously a depleting resource as well that needs to be considered. And thinking about all of that, it's kind of understandable that desalination is becoming the only point. It's however energy intensive it is, water is a very important resource, and you do need to get it for your population at the end of the day. And it seems that that's the best way.
It's an important point, because I think a lot of the focus on water shortage goes on growing population, people are wasteful with their water, like big cities. But actually, when you look at it on a more macro level, industry and agriculture takes up far more water than just personal consumption.
Absolutely.
Like, I read a statistic about South Africa that all of the water shortages that are felt by particularly the poorer parts of the population could be relieved by using the same water that goes into the nation's wine crop every year. It just goes into growing grapes. So it shows you where priorities are, I suppose, as a country.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there's this, when it comes to water, and speaking about water, there is this whole other topic, which sadly doesn't get mentioned enough, and it's the meat industry, how much water it uses. And it also uses very, very large amounts of water. Obviously, people don't consider that, but obviously if you're growing a cow, let's say from being a baby up until it's older. It's not just the meat industry, but it's obviously also the dairy industry, and you need to continuously grow crops for them to feed on, and that needs water, and you need to also continuously feed them water. And then once you take their products to factories, that also needs water. And there's a lot of talk happening right now, not necessarily about switching diets to complete being a complete vegan, but there is definitely talks going around about reducing our meat intake for environmental purposes. And that goes on to other things. It's not just the water, but the meat industry in general. It does produce a lot of greenhouse gases as well, which are very bad, obviously, as well. It produces a very large percentage of greenhouse gases. And there is this wider talk about this being one of the paths we should take to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, our water use, and I do believe in that. I do think that that's a good idea, whether it's going to be a tax on these kinds of products, on meat products or water-intensive products, whether it's going to be subsidies on other products, but there needs to be something done.
I think this is a really fascinating topic, and I'm actually working on an episode about the sort of beef farming industry, yeah. Livestock industry. I'm tentatively calling it Why Cows Aren't Necessarily Evil, because the research that I've been looking into is that the way we generally conduct beef farming, as you said, in like factory farms where the cows need a lot of inputs like grains, water, and then you have all these environmental issues, like you have their you have to store all their manure, because obviously that's just, you know, you have to do something with that. It's not part becoming part of the ecosystem or anything. And basically just the way we conduct beef farming is just like totally insane from an environmental point of view. That's not necessarily the cow's fault. I mean, if you just left the cow in a field to do what cows do, they would have a much smaller footprint. And there's really interesting studies about this, you know, looking at particular farms, like, you know, that grow like grass-fed beef. And because you can actually use cows to regenerate soil, they can actually help to sequester carbon.
Okay.
If you put them on soil that is, you know, has been damaged and has released carbon in the past, they can actually help to recover the soil if they're managed properly. But it's just that almost no one is doing this. You know, it's like, it's a totally niche thing.
No, it's very interesting. It's absolutely the way it's the way with kind of everything around the world, in some sense, with if you do it in a sustainable way, if you do it in a, if you don't go out crazy on it, that's what it's all about, you know, like you said. And I think it's overconsumption that's kind of causing these problems. And like you said, if you left cows as grass-fed beef and whatnot, that could definitely help. It's the problem that's happening now is that we are overproducing, and we are, you know, people are expecting to have a certain meal that includes beef, let's say, rather than once a week, they're expecting to have it once every 2 days, and that can all change. We can move to that more sustainable way of consumption if those thoughts can be changed potentially in the future for the good of the environment.
And also, I think we waste 1/3 of all of our food just goes in the waste. So it's a bit like what you said about the, you know, we lose half of our water just from leaks in pipes and stuff. Like, if we can just make the system more efficient, we could solve so many, or go part of the way to solving so many problems.
Absolutely. And that should always be the first thing we do. You know, this focus on kind of innovative solutions and innovative design, it's always interesting, but at the end of the day, if you just make something more efficient, if you reduce your losses, it just goes such a big way in solving these problems.
So that, I mean, that's a nice segue into one question I had about we see a lot, particularly the richer parts of the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia and Dubai, they're investing very heavily in very innovative, flashy, you know, famous kind of projects, whether it's new cities, like the Masdar new city, which is meant to be totally, I think, carbon neutral and very sustainable and very futuristic. It has a lot of new technology, like autonomous public transport and things like that. Where do you see the role of that compared to just, as you said, doing the basic stuff, like just fixing what we have now and making things run a bit more efficiently?
I mean, I I obviously there is new innovation and it does help, but when it comes to sustainability and when you think about how the basic need for people is to be able to live in cities and live in buildings, that's obviously what the basic goal of a building is to provide, or a city is to provide. It's to provide certain services, but it's to keep people sheltered, to keep them safe, and to give them a good environment to live in. And cities have been successfully doing that for thousands of years in lots of different areas around the world. So we as humans have adapted different building technologies, different ways of building, different ways of living a long time ago to be able to live in hot areas, in cold areas, in humid areas. And what's happening now is what I see is happening now is a lot of clients and a lot of people looking for this next innovative solution. They're looking for this next big discovery that's going to change the way they're living, that's going to get them comfortable living while being sustainable. While I feel that we've already done that before, and I think rather than looking into the future much, we should also look at the past and look how things were done. You hear a lot about vernacular architecture in certain areas, and that is to a certain degree, it is applied. And I think people do look at these things, but it should be even applied more. When you think about those new cities, when you think about those new buildings that certain clients are asking for in the Middle East, or that are being built in the Middle East, whether it's tall glass buildings, whether it's parks, I think people need to take a step back and think about whether this is suitable for that area.
Mm.
Whether a tall glass building is suitable in any area in some sense. It's is it required? I mean, you know, you see whenever one of these buildings is built, before it's built, you always see these renders that give you the see-through glass and you see these amazing views from the inside. But in reality, the buildings are going to overheat because wherever you put them, there's going to be a lot of sun hitting them. They're going to overheat and you're going to need air conditioning. And then because of too much sun, because of glare, they end up making all half of these windows tinted. So it looks like these kind of dark blue buildings. And just kind of you build this thing and then you try and solve the problems, when in reality I think there's certain problems that everyone knows are there, or climate challenges. I don't like using the word problem, but let's say climate challenges are there. There are ways to solve them, and I think that should be the approach from the very beginning. In very hot countries, one thing you can do, for example, is build more underground where the ground is cooler than the outside, and you benefit from your walls being surrounded by earth rather than by the outside, which is hot. That's one way it can be done, using thermal mass, for example, to balance out the heat and the cool during the day and at night. Doing a lot of natural ventilation as well, that's been done before and that is doable. So, you know, the whole idea of looking for a very much more efficient system of air conditioning, you know, maybe it would help, and I'm not completely dismissing all of these solutions. Obviously, they are there for a reason and they will help, but at the same time, they should be also combined with some of these old methods that we've used. Again, we've lived that way for thousands of years, so why do we suddenly now need other things? Do we need them, or are we just kind of trying to build them to give out a statement in some sense, rather than just to provide the shelter?
Well, it's very true, because I mean, especially when you look at somewhere like Dubai, which is obviously, you know, it's almost Manhattan, like these, like, you know, incredible tall buildings. And I mean, it's not because that region had a huge population boom and it had to, you know, go to hyper density to house people. It's purely an expression of wealth and of you know, landmarking to the world that this place is open for business and that you can come here, you know, as an attraction, and there's things to, you know, there's things happening here. It's an exciting place. And that's why I think a lot of, you know, there's a disconnect between the, as you said, the old solutions that do work and have been proven to work for thousands of years, and then people's ambitions of what this future should look like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, especially in the Middle East, and this is something we've touched upon before as well, but it's going back to the whole Western kind of idea of how the Middle East is. But there's also a problem with applying certain Western kind of, whether it's city making, urban planning, building making, into areas where it's not so much suitable as much. And that's when you know, when you have clients, for example, requesting for these tall glass buildings, obviously they've seen some, for example, let's say in Manhattan, and there the climate, I'm not completely defending tall glass buildings because I don't think they're suitable anywhere in the world personally. But there they kind of still semi maybe work and somewhere there. But for example, taking that and applying the same exact design, the same exact way of thinking into an area with a completely different climate, it brings up more problems than solutions. And it's the same with whether it's city planning, urban planning. It's the same with, you know, you see these parks being designed in some areas, in some countries in the Middle East, in some cities as well. And whether that should be there in the first place. Obviously, you do still need some form of green landscaping, but are the choices of the plants being made, or is it correct? Does it have to look very, very green? Does it have to have deer running around and tall green trees? You know, it's that kind of way of thinking. And I think that goes back again to the vernacular architecture. And there are solutions to all of these things. You don't need very wide pavements, for example, and wide roads where people can walk. In reality, in these some of these hotter areas, what you need is much narrower streets where people can walk and be shaded from the sun during the summer months, and have air kind of pass through in a more efficient manner and cool down everyone. There is one thing that's happened, obviously, all around the world with newer cities that has to have happened, and it's the fact that there are cars around now, and we're designing cities also around cars. That's a problem, and that needs to be, in some sense, rectified as we go on in the future. It's not just I'm approaching this not from the angle of the fact that cars obviously produce greenhouse gas emissions, but I'm also approaching this from the space they take from everyone else, from everything else. You know, we're in London at the moment, and there's not many places in London where you can go to a cafe and just sit outside without having cars completely passing by, being very loud and taking up a lot of space, even pavements. You see people walking, it's narrow pavements, and it's all because cars are taking space. And I think as we go into the future, that needs to slowly change. And there needs to be a lot more space and a lot more priority given to people walking, to the actual city in some sense, to give place to shops, to more, not more parks necessarily, but more areas for walking, more shaded routes for walking in the case of the Middle East. And that's something that I feel should be applied all around the world. And that's at the moment not being done. And even for cities that we're seeing that will be built in 20 years or are being built and will be finished in 10 years, sadly, there is still a lot of priority being given to roads. And it seems to be what drives the design in some instances.
I'm fascinated by the urban design of old Middle Eastern cities. You know, if you look at somewhere like Urdu or like one of these really ancient cities, the urban form is so dense, as you said, the streets are very narrow, and that's not you know, that's not an accident, or that's not, you know, it's not just because there was no cars there. It's because if you can keep the streets very narrow, it means they're always in shadow for much of the day, and it keeps it cool, it keeps it to a good temperature, so you can actually go out and walk around. Whereas now I think we've been designing cities so long with these very wide roads, and actually the standards for roads in for instance Saudi are just like absolutely gigantic. They have these like 6-lane roads going through cities, and then they have another like massive sidewalk, which is like nobody uses, of course, because it's beside a 6-lane road. So they've totally gone the other direction in terms of opening up the space so much so that it gets very, very hot. And then of course at that point, all you can do is get in your car and drive from one air conditioned place to another. And another thing, actually, we were talking about wind earlier, and you know, when we build tall buildings in like the UK, you have to do tests on it to minimize the excessive wind it produces. So, you know, tall buildings will sort of deflect wind down and create turbulence. It can actually be quite dangerous if it's not designed properly. Yep. But in somewhere like Saudi, these places in the Middle East, they for thousands of years they've been designing these kind of towers. I think they're called wind towers, are they?
Yeah.
That are slightly larger you know, maybe like twice the height of the normal buildings, and they help to just deflect the wind through the streets, actually cools them down even more.
I mean, these are obviously very, very good ideas, and that's exactly what kind of should be used in some sense. Wind is very good because you always know where it's coming from, or in some sense you know more or less where it's going to come
most
from
of the time, yeah.
Most of the time, exactly, you can easily predict it, and because of this you can design these kind of wind towers. You can also design certain kind of wind chimneys within households to push for more ventilation. So if so even individual households, what you can have is if they have windows, for example, and air passing through them, they can be kind of sucked out from these chimneys if they're facing the opposite direction of the predominant wind direction, for example. So there's a lot of these small solutions that can work, and because they've been done for so long, we just know they work as well, and that's what I think should be done more often. They should be applied more often, and at the moment they're not. Going back to something very interesting you were talking about as well, about dense kind of architecture and dense urban forms, that's definitely a very important way of going forward as well, because once again, going to how cities are being designed and built now, and you've worked on some of the projects that I've worked on, so you are aware of this, but there's this tendency to divide new master plans or new cities into individual areas where you have the residential here, the commercial somewhere else, and then the offices, for example, or the retail somewhere completely different. So you have this completely residential area, and everyone who lives there has to all get to the commercial area first to go and work in their offices. And then during the weekend, they all move from there to the retail area to do their shopping or to go out and whatnot. And that actually it can lead to problems, this type of urban form, where in reality, what you can have is a combined kind of urban form. So you have streets that both have resi, they have commercial areas, they have retail areas. That stops areas from being dead during certain times of the week. So going back to, it's a very simple example, but since we're in London, I'll mention London. But if you go to Bank and that area, Liverpool High Street as well, if you go to that area during the weekend, there is no one there.
Yeah.
And it's very, very packed during the week, but there's no one there during the weekend. And that's kind of it's a shame that there are certain areas that empty and then fill up kind of again. And what we're trying to do with this kind of dense, more dense urban form is have every area be not busy, but be lively in some sense, and less busy than how it would have been if it was a standalone area.
Mm.
So if you lived somewhere and you were just a 10-minute walk away from your office and then a 20-minute walk away from some restaurants, you would stay more in that area during the week. You probably would go to other areas, but at least you've got everything around you, rather than having a whole neighborhood of similar houses all around you and then having to drive up to your office or drive up to the shopping area. And that still keeps on happening with certain projects that we work on, and with new buildings that are happening, with new kind of master plans, is that whole separation. And it's not very efficient, and it removes opportunities. It removes good opportunities for people to kind of spend more time in certain areas rather than just use this area as just an area for me to go to the office. This area is just for me to sleep in. This area is just for me to do my shopping in. Well, that all can be combined in some sense.
It's interesting that in the Middle East, they've sort of imported North American planning principles, like what was happening, you know, and you know, in the UK as well, in fairness, back in, you know, like the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was all about that separation of uses. You had your out-of-town shopping malls, and you had your kind of office district, and you had your suburbs. They were all very separate, and you had to drive between them all. And of course, we've turned around in the profession. We've looked back and said, this is not what we should, you know, this was a mistake to some extent, and now we're trying to rectify that. But it doesn't seem to be spreading to everywhere. It's sort of some places they're still building massive roads and still separating out all their uses and everything as if it was, you know, 50 years ago.
And you're right. I mean, I think there's still a tendency with anyone to still think that cars kind of should rule the design, because it is, at the end of the day, it's all ruled by cars. When you talk about having a shopping mall that's further out, it's the thought process is that anyone who has a car can just drive up there. It's easier. It's And fair enough, back then it might have made a bit of sense before we realized how much busier our roads were going to get, how many problems we're getting out of all of this. And I think that kind of whole thing about cars leading the way is still sadly relevant in some sense. There's within the Middle East, at least I know, I can speak quite a lot about these things about Jordan because obviously I'm from there, but I think it also applies in a lot of other countries. And I think there's public transport doesn't get used as much as it should, and that's got, it's a bit of a, not a cultural thing, but it's a bit of a, it is a bit of a cultural thing. And I think most households own a car. And in that sense, they don't see the point of having to take a bus. The kind of the public transport network is not built up enough to make it more worthwhile for people. Yeah. The better alternative, exactly. Cars are expensive there, for example, so it does put off a lot of people from taking cars. But there's also a lot of taxis, and taxis are very cheap there, for example. So, and if you think about it, it does make sense. If you had to pay, let's say, £5 to get into a taxi and get to your office, and it's completely empty, and the taxi is going to come pick you up from your own house, and it's going to drop you exactly in front of your office, or you're going to have to take a bus that, where you have to walk quite a bit to it, and it's going to drop you a bit off, and it's going to cost three instead of five, let's say.
Exactly, yeah.
People would take the taxi, and it makes sense in that sense. And I think that's kind of where we have to head, where we kind of had to head towards. In London, it's quite amazing how many people take the tube, how many people take the bus, but it's also, if there was an alternative that was the same price as a bus that gave you a lot more comfort, people would take that immediately. People would jump on that. And Uber has shown us that people take Uber a lot of times for just mild inconvenience reasons. That I don't feel like taking the bus. I want to get home 5 minutes before. I don't want to walk there.
It's raining. And they just don't want to walk to the bus.
It's raining. Exactly. Exactly. So it's very easy to switch to that comfort. And I think we just need to, it's a process of kind of slowly eroding away this whole car culture and replacing it completely with a very comfortable public transport network. Obviously, there are things like cycling that need to be pushed. Cycling is a bit tough in that area because, as we've talked, the temperatures there can go very high, they can go very low. And in a lot of these cities, because they were built some long time ago, some of them are built on hills, some of them are built in kind of very, very high topography kind of areas. So it's a bit more difficult to say that, people can cycle when it's all up and down. But I think there's a lot of opportunities for walking. There's a lot of opportunities for completely moving towards that. And it doesn't involve building new things. It doesn't involve building new master plans, new cities. It just involves look at what we have now and let's work on this and make it a better place to live.
It's a bit less attractive as an investment. I guess that's part of the issue as well. To invest in cycling is not as sexy as a whole new city out in the desert.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that happened quite a lot there is those, some of those projects need to be fancy and they need to be sexy. Like you said, you know, it's not just, we're just changing this road into a more, you know, no one's interested in this, but you know, when you open the news, when you open the BBC and you hear that Saudi Arabia or Qatar is building a whole new city that's going to be completely sustainable, it just sounds so fancy and it attracts people, and it's, in some sense, it's how the world works, but it's a shame it's like that.
But it's also I mean, people taking a kind of emotional view on it rather than actually, if you looked at the numbers, you know, investing in cycling is like one of the best things you can do as a city in terms of the amount you invest and the amount you get back in terms of reducing congestion, improved health of the population, improved productivity. You know, it's when you look at all the factors involved, it's really good, but people aren't necessarily taking a logical you know, adding up all the figures and taking a logical response. They're just saying, you know, I want to do something that I'll be remembered by, and I'm going to build, you know, design a new master plan. It's going to be amazing.
I mean, I think that's a general problem across all countries. Is this whole not considering your social costs, not considering your social benefits, your external benefits, not considering long-term kind of effects? Because, you know, anything you do now, it's going to take time. If you start getting rid of highway, not highways, but if you start getting rid of cars, let's say, in the middle of cities and replace it with something, it's not going to work immediately. It's not going to click immediately. Mm. It might take a few years for it to work. Afterwards, it will be very good. And afterwards, people will remember you as someone who did the good thing, the right thing. But during that period of time, 5 to 10 years, you know, it's not going to be a very popular thing. And I think that's what we need, is someone to really look at all of these social kind of benefits and costs. Like you said, I mean, when you think about cycling, people think, oh, okay, fine, yeah, less cars, less, yeah. But they don't think that actually the population is going to be healthier as well. More people will be willing to go out and move, and it's an exercise for people. And all of these benefits, you need to account for them.
Mm.
When someone just keeps taking his car every day to the office and back, compared to when someone takes a bike, especially when we're thinking about these more dense kind of master plans where it is close enough where you can just cycle somewhere in 10 minutes rather than having to cycle for an hour or something. But rather than driving for 5 minutes each way, you just cycle 10 minutes each way. The benefits are immense. You save space, you're producing less CO2, and whoever is cycling is getting healthier as well. So it's amazing. It's a win-win in some sense.
Yeah, I mean, sustainability isn't just about the carbon emissions. It's also about the social and economic elements
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
Something I was thinking about in terms of making public transport more attractive for people. So I think, I mean, in many cities, maybe, you know, some cities don't have any public transport. Some of them just have a few, like, grungy buses that, you know, like, people only take if it's their last resort, basically. But, I mean, I have seen, like, for instance, in Dublin is a city that is very much, I would say, car-dominated. And then the main form of public transport is buses. And so you just get, you know, thousands and thousands of buses moving through the street. And, you know, over the last sort of 20 years, they've invested in the Lewis tram line. So the first tram line that went in, linking the south of the city up to the city centre, it actually, because it's so nice and it's so like shiny and new and it's kind of elegant, it became a sort of posh public transport. and partly also because it went through, you know, sort of more middle class neighbourhoods. The first line went through. It sort of became this thing like, oh, you're taking the Lewis, what, you're too good for the bus kind of thing. So, you know, and now it's spread out. It has, I think, three lines now, and it's become much more of like just a default form of transport that you would take, that anyone in society would take. So it can happen just if you just make it nice enough, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if it works, it works. It doesn't. You know, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter why people like it, as long as they like it and they're taking it. They think they're posh, that, okay, fair enough. At least you're taking it, you know. That's all good. But I completely agree with you, because that is definitely the way. I mean, I think public transport can be looked down upon in countries where they don't have that much public transport already. And they think, oh, this is for people who can't afford a car, or this is for people who don't want to buy a car and can't afford to get a cab or something. And that kind of thought process needs to be changed for it to work. I completely agree with you. If you make it seem like, oh, wow, this is, it's quite a nice thing, it's nicer than taking my car, then people would definitely take it. I completely agree with you.
I wanted to come on to a topic that I know we both find very interesting, which is that you mentioned earlier that we're already seeing this sort of changes in climate. Because of climate change, raises in temperature, you can actually measure it and you sort of know what the effects are happening. And we're also thinking about what will happen in the near and medium term future and how we need to be designing for that as well. And I think the question becomes, you know, should we be designing cities and managing cities to adapt to these new conditions? Or are we still trying to, you know, is there any use in still trying to actually prevent climate change through our urban design? The sort of two strands there.
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. And I think we're definitely heading towards doing both in some sense at the moment. You know, there's no use pretending that even now things are not in some sense happening, getting worse. We're currently under, obviously, a lockdown in London, like you said, because of the coronavirus. And anything that happens now is going to have an effect on everything else. That's how our world works at the moment. And you've seen how a virus in China, for example, has had an effect on the whole world, basically. And that's how slowly we're getting more and more of these kind of natural disasters in some sense. And it's not just natural disasters, but these extreme weather events as well. And with climate change, it's not that these some of these conditions are going to increase, or it's not that they're just going to get worse, but it's just that their frequency of something happening, which is quite bad, is going to continuously increase. So if you think about a bad flood, it used to happen once every 10 years. Now it might happen once every 5 years instead. If you think about hurricanes, instead of them happening once every 100 years or something, a horrible one, it might happen once every 20 years. And it's that kind of statistics of it happening more often. And that is, in some sense, happening now already. We're seeing a lot of things happening now. We're seeing extreme heat conditions. We're seeing every year temperature records are being broken. And it might go back again down. But the thing is, this increase has happened now, and it's going to happen more often. And that's the idea. It's not that the temperatures are going to stay hot and they're going to keep going up. It's just that these extreme weather events are more likely to happen. And when they do happen, they're going to be worse and worse. And because this is happening now, I do think we should definitely start designing to adapt. We should decrease as well. And I think we need to head towards a point where we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And it's taking this whole climate change thing out of it. It's also because they're finishing. You know, fossil fuel is finishing. It's going to get depleted. And we need to find another solution if we want to survive. And why not use a solution that works both ways? It works both in reducing your CO2, and it's both never going to perish. It's never going to finish the sun, you know, not for another billion years. I think it's still going to be in the sky. So that's all right. And I think that's a very important kind of thing to start thinking about, is we need to switch to both. And part of becoming a more adaptable, more resilient, a more resilient city, or a more resilient building even, is also reducing your reliance on things that will get depleted in some sense, and reducing your reliance on anything in some sense as well. I think when we talk about resilience of cities, of buildings, or adaptability against climate change, one angle is against climate change, but there's also other angles. You can talk about it against something like COVID. You can talk about it against things like a terrorist attack, a cyber terrorist attack. It can be food shortage, water shortage. You need to be resilient against all of these things, and cities need to be able to adapt so that if anything does happen, then it can still function as a city and it won't crumble completely. It won't get stopped. And that's part of what we try and design for, or what we should, I believe, design for in the future. It's definitely about stopping climate change, but you need to also think about all of these things. There are a lot of islands. There are a lot of coastal cities that will get affected by sea level rise, for example. So we should obviously focus on reducing sea level rise in the future, but we should also be building defenses to make sure that they don't completely sink, or do an economic study so that, okay, part of this can, for example, sink as long as we move the population to another area or build another area. And for example, when you do build a new city, a new building, you do need to be considering all of these things. And making sure that the building can adapt against it. LEED, for example, I believe, does give these optional kind of extra credits for things like whether a building can, in case of an electricity shortage or in case of electricity completely turning off, can it still maintain a comfort temperature inside for, I can't remember, for I think half a day or one day, which is a very interesting thing to look at. So if you've got an office in a freezing area and suddenly the electricity goes off, is the temperature inside the office going to still be comfortable, or is it going to be very, very cold suddenly, and vice versa if it's very hot outside? And that's kind of what we talk about when we talk about resilience and adaptability.
I'm fascinated by this idea of resilience, and it's something that I've steered away from talking about on the podcast just because it's so wide ranging. I don't know if I can do it justice. But I mean, do you have an easy sort of description or way of conceptualizing resilience?
There's different definitions to it. It's basically the capability of in this case a city to kind of immediately jump back from something hitting it. So let's say suddenly it rains a lot, there's a flash flood. How quickly or how capable is a city being able to get rid of that flash flood immediately and going on and working up to its optimal kind of can people still go to work, or is it going to stop people going from work? Is it going to cut supply lines? That you know, that kind of thing. I see it a lot as having, and this funnily enough, I talk a lot about efficiency. This is the exact opposite of efficiency in some sense, but I do see it as requiring redundancy. Mm. And in that sense, what I mean is that you should have more of everything. So for water, you should have enough water storage for 3 days, for example, if water is cut. For food, you should have the food storage. For your electricity, you should have other generators. You should have something that can kick in as soon as something bad happens. We've seen a couple of months ago with the Beirut explosion, for example, that a grain storage unit that got completely destroyed along with the port. And that was the main way from which they were getting a lot of their grains and a lot of their food. And in this sense, you start talking about this is a perfect example in some sense of things kind of going wrong and preventing any food from coming in, of supply not coming in. And they needed to immediately find another way of bringing food in, of being able to supply their population in. And that's what I talk about in terms of redundancy. So if something like this happens, and that's how we should be designing our future cities. I don't think cities are designed in a way yet, but how we should design our future cities is, if something like this, hopefully nothing ever happens like this again, but if something like this happens again, is there another way for people to immediately get their food and be confident that they can get their food? Should something like this lead to a disaster? Because these things do happen, and they happen very, very rarely, but when they do happen, it's a very big problem. I like to think a lot about this, it's a bit of a similar thing to the human body, where we do have a lot of redundant parts. Mm-hmm. In some sense, we have two eyes, we have we have two lungs, and we operate obviously very well with both of them, but we can still operate and live with just one of them. And in some sense, because of this, you can argue that the human body isn't very efficient, because do we need all of these extra parts? But we do have them. And if something happens to one of your hands, you can still do a lot with your other hand. If something happens to one of your fingers, you still have 9 others that you can do a lot with. Not as well, but you can still do a lot. And I think that's kind of the way we should think about cities, the way we should think about buildings. It's more organic thinking, that if something does happen to them, do we have something else that can perform the same job? Maybe not as well, but do we have something? You know, is the city going to come to a halt, or can it continue?
I've never heard that analogy before. That's great. I really like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's for me the whole topic of resilience and what it's about. But it's definitely this whole redundancy thing. It definitely goes a lot against efficiency, because you're not designing a very efficient system. You're designing two very efficient systems instead, and it costs more. It costs more to run it, to keep it. So there is that angle that people take, which is, well, it's not efficient to design cities in such a way.
But you need that safety net for when something inevitably goes wrong.
You need that safety net. You do get economists who can talk about kind of measuring up disasters and whether their economic cost is as high as these safety nets. So, for example, going back to the Beirut example, if we did have another grain store and another port over the past 20 that were built over the past 20 years, how much would they have cost, and how much would it have cost to upkeep them? Would that cost be less than the cost of the disaster that happened now? And then you start thinking about whether it's worth it or not. So there is certain metrics you can use, but I still think that, you know, it's not all about, at the end of the day, the cost. It's not all about looking at the different economic costs of the different things. It's also about looking at the human cost, in some sense, the social cost of all
quality
this.
Of life and
quality of life.
It's amazing how reliant we are in the world of everything running smoothly as it should, and then how quickly things go wrong when one piece, like for instance at the beginning of coronavirus, everyone freaked out, and the supermarket shelves for about a week or two back in March in London were just totally empty. I remember going shopping in like a really big supermarket, thinking, oh, they'll definitely have, you know, some food, because there's such a big supermarket. Literally the only thing there was Brussels sprouts and Easter eggs. There's not many meals you can make with those two ingredients. So actually another thing that I remember was a few years ago when the bridge in Genoa in Italy collapsed, and in certain places products from Italy just disappeared from supermarket shelves within a few days. So for instance, I remember seeing pictures of like pasta shelves just like totally empty, because that was just one major...
That was the only way
to get the food up. Yeah. And once that's gone, then suddenly it only takes a few days for all the food to run out, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where you need something like another safety system, you know, just in case something like this happens. And it can be, I mean, I was talking about cities now, but it can definitely be applied to a whole country scale where you can't have one area completely depending on one supply line. It needs some kind of other thing. It needs a safety net, absolutely. And it's a very good point you've made. And it's a very good point you've made about food shortages here as well. And funnily enough, I think for Qatar, they only ever always have a 24-hour supply of water that's on standby. So if something goes wrong, they only have water for 24 hours. I think it was a number like this a couple of years ago. I think it was 24 hours one day. But it's crazy how, like you said, you know, you wake up, everything's running smoothly, but you don't know how much on the edge all of these systems are, and how much a little small thing, what effect it can have on everything else. And and I think we need to move away from this if we are to kind of survive in this age of more problems potentially happening, more kind of potentially natural disasters happening. And you know, going back to the coronavirus, a lot of the reason why it's spread so much is because of globalization as well. It's because everyone is connected. So it's not very difficult to imagine something like that potentially happening again in the future. But we need to have another solution. We need to have a kind of a plan in place to do something if that happens again, and not completely drop, you know, as we sadly did in this kind of case.
Move to New Zealand. I think that's the answer. Seems to be the only place.
Yeah, they seem to be doing the best. Yeah, it's the only place that's doing the right thing.
There's also this part of resilience. It's often described, as you said, about how quickly can you bounce back to equilibrium after a shock or you know, a shock or a stress, something going wrong. There's also this other idea that it can also be like a bouncing forward, where when you get knocked, now that the context has changed, instead of going back to the old equilibrium, you reset to a new equilibrium.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can kind of, we're seeing this a bit currently with COVID, with new ideas coming out, with new businesses coming out, new ways of thinking coming out. And I think it's what a lot of people do want. They don't want to go back necessarily to the old equilibrium. They do want more to come back to a new equilibrium, something with more, whether it's more flexible working hours, whether it's more freedom. I think people staying home have realized that they don't mind going to the office, but they've realized that actually there's a lot of other new things that they found they could do home, whether it's new hobbies, whether it's new passion. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of new time that people have found with themselves. And I think people are slowly realizing that this is the new equilibrium they want. And I think that's a very important thing. I think every time something like this happens, you definitely can't immediately think about resetting to your old equilibrium. You need to stop and take a look at what's happening now. You need to take a stop and look at what you want to go back to and assess the situation. Was that the good thing, or can I find a better thing in some sense?
Well, it ties back into our previous conversation about investing in cycling and walking. There's a lot of cities around the world, because of COVID, are now finally putting in the investment that their cities need for cycle lanes, for traffic calming, making it more comfortable for walking and cycling, because these are now not only sustainable modes of transport, but they're also safe in terms of infectious disease for the most part.
Yeah.
Better than being in a stuffed tube train anyway, or a bus. So we are sort of, you're right, we are sort of seeing that shift to a new equilibrium, hopefully one that will serve us better in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very positive way of looking at things as well, I think. And it's a very important way of looking at things, because when going back to resilience, when you think about something like a disaster hitting, you need to try and make the best out of it. And there's always progress. There's always moving forward. And it's, what better time to move forward than that in some sense? And that's what's happening with us with COVID now. Finally, we've got the chance to, you know, look at how the world can work without many people going to the office all the time, with less busy cities. And with kind of your local neighborhoods being slowly much busier, your local cafes making a lot. And we've had a look at this, and I think people like what they're seeing, and I think most people would agree that this is a good thing. So now we have to do something about it to not forget about this and not move away from it.
Yeah, it will be a big, I think, you know, we're seeing in a way the revitalization of our local neighborhoods, because now there's a lot more people around during the day to use these cafes and shops that, you know, I mean, okay, right now in England, they're all closed. Well, they will be closed,
from Thursday
because there's a lockdown. So obviously that's nowhere near ideal. But, you know, imagine this situation when we're, we have much less. The virus is not a problem.
Cases.
That would be really, really good for our local areas, but it could be devastating for our city centres, which rely on people coming in to the office and supporting the sort of the other businesses like the cafes and the stationery shops and all the incidental stuff where you spend money because you're in the city centre to be there for work. And I think we need to see a really big reimagining of what a city centre is after COVID. And it could be very interesting to see if it becomes a place to live again. And as you said, not just a place that's dead at the weekend because there's no suits on the streets, as they say.
Yeah, no, I think that if I had to kind of place a bet on something, that would probably be the thing I would like to imagine, or the thing that I would really, really like to happen is all of these areas slowly becoming also local neighborhoods in some sense. That would probably be the best kind of case. And, you know, when I talk about these things, I'm never saying completely get rid of Oxford Street and turn it into a residential area as well. You need one of these things, two of these things. It doesn't hurt. But having these areas completely isolated and completely separate from everywhere else, you know, going back to Bank is always the best kind of example, because it really is completely empty and dead during the weekend. And it's a shame. It is. And that can be changed.
One of the most beautiful parts of London, and it's not really enjoyed to its maximum, I think. It's mostly just full of people rushing around between offices and getting on the tube and stuff.
Absolutely.
It's actually a beautiful place to walk around, and especially during the weekend because it's empty, so you get to have the place to yourself.
Yeah, no, I've had a few walks there over the weekend. It's very nice, and it's very nice to walk in it, but there's not much you can do in some sense around there. Like, there's not many, even some of the restaurants and the shops are sometimes closed because they know there's no one there during the weekend. But it has a lot of potential, and I think that's a very important thing to think about, that it does have a lot of potential and it could change into something much, much better in some sense.
There comes back to this idea of adaptability, though, because you've got these very large floor plates, skyscrapers that are there designed specifically for offices, and if the market for offices falls out in many cities, what can you do with these buildings? They're very hard to retrofit for residential use, aren't they?
They would need to be in some sense, even if they're hard, but they would need to be, I think. Now kind of looking at certain design standards, well, looking at the BREEAM standard, it's very interesting that you mentioned that, but one of the things about it is that it's not a compulsory point, but it's an extra credit that you can have, is if you design your building in such a way that it can be retrofitted easily. So it's called future adaptability, and it's things like having your internal walls easily replaceable, having kind of systems that allow for different types of offices or different types of uses to be able to make of that space, and anything that you build ideally should follow these kinds of things, so that, like you said, if these stop being offices and want to be turned into a residential kind of area, then you should be able to turn them easily into a residential area. They might, at the end of the day, stay offices for people who still live there, for example. They don't have to necessarily turn into residential, but most of it is like that, so you would need to turn some of it into residential, I guess. But yeah, this whole adaptability, it's also about having these places that can deliver different functions again. So, you know, a shop that can be turned into an office, that can potentially be turned into a house, serving all of these different functions.
Yeah, think about these buildings in London, all over the UK and Europe, that are over 100 years old, beautiful buildings, and maybe they started off as a large residence for some wealthy wealthy person. And then over time, they got subdivided into flats. And then at some point, they became a business place and you put offices in them. And now, and then, yeah. You know, they've been reconverted back to some other arrangement of residential. You know, it's like we sort of have done this already in the past where we've maybe not even consciously. I don't know if the architects who were designing like the Georgian terraces actually thought that they would ever, you know, be changed into workplaces or modified or anything. They probably wanted them just to be left as they designed them, probably. But they were just inherently adaptable, which is probably why they've stood the test of time and we still use them. Whereas I think a lot of stuff we're designing now is very narrowly focused on this is the
single use.
This is always going to be the use.
I completely agree with you. And I think there's one other point I also wanted to mention about this whole thing about having these kind of tight communities next to each other is the, it's not just that people can go, let's say if you do have residential in bank for some reason at one point, plus offices, plus retail, for example, it's not just that people can get from one place to another easily and enjoy it over the weekend, but there's so much potential symbiosis between all of these areas. You know, you can have an office, for example, that has a lot of computers that heats up a lot, and that heat can be just taken and used to heat some of the houses around it, for example. And I've seen that. I've seen the very interesting way of doing this. I think it was in Germany where there was a big, I can't remember which company it was, but it was a big company. They had a lot of computer servers, and these computer servers, they heat up a lot, and the air conditioning for cooling them down is normally massive. So instead of keeping the servers in their own offices, they just put them in people's houses.
No way.
And they doubled up as radiators. Obviously, you have less control over when they heat and when they don't, but they did it in such a way to provide a continuously comfortable environment for people. And if it gets too hot, you can just open the window in some sense, because that energy is free energy, you know, and you're not really, it's not the end of the world if you're kind of wasting some of it. But this energy would have been air conditioned away. Yeah. And now they're just using it to heat buildings, which would have been heated anyway. And it's genius. And that can't happen if you have all the residential separate from the commercial, separate from the retail. These opportunities can't come out at all.
I love that example. That's great. It's one of those things where I bet the first person who thought of that idea, everyone else said, "What? You can't do that. That's crazy. It'll never work." And then you just think, "Why not? You know, like we can make it work.
Why not? Yeah. Why wouldn't it? Yeah, exactly."
So I'm going to surprise you slightly because we didn't talk about this before, but it's a question I ask all the guests who come on, which is that we're at a pivotal moment now for action on climate change. And you see, cities and countries around the world making declarations that they will reduce carbon emissions and adapt to climate change. So we literally have a few number of decades to really turn everything around. From your perspective, what would you like to be done? What would you like to see being done differently in the next coming years as we sort of tackle this issue?
I think that there's at the moment with countries, because obviously countries are making declarations, governments are making declarations. I still feel that it's very individualistic in terms of the countries. And I think this has been the biggest problem with solving climate change, because we all know that, for example, India and China are some of the biggest producers of greenhouse gas emissions at the moment. And they obviously, because they're producing a lot, they maybe have a bigger duty to stop or reduce their emissions. But at the same time, the angle a lot of people are coming from is that why should India reduce theirs and reduce their kind of, not evolution, but their kind of economic progress and their kind of growth, when countries like the UK already did all of that, and countries like the UK have actually produced the most over the past 300 years. They've stopped now, that's true, but they've already reaped the benefits from their industrial revolution in some sense. They've used they've produced a lot of greenhouse gas emissions already, and in exchange for that, they are where they are now. While countries like India, China, and a lot of developing countries haven't had that chance to. So what's happening now is it fair to ask some of these other countries to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions when countries like the UK have benefited so much from it? What's the solution to that? And I don't know what the solution is. It's a very big problem because you can think about it in both perspectives, but you know, you can say, but India and China are producing the most. They have to reduce it if we're ever gonna get out of this. And then on the other hand, you can say, but we've not had any industrial revolution. The people who have produced the most are actually the UK and the US over their history. They're not producing now, but over their history, they've produced the most. And I think that this is where you need to break this whole individualistic countries. They need to help each other. And the UK has obviously benefited a lot. They need to go and help and show other countries that, look, if you reduce your CO2 emissions, we will help you. We will help you progress. We will help you do the growth that we've done. Because if you don't do that, why this individualistic nature of countries means that they want to still always be better than other countries. What's the motivation for one country which is growing a lot and becoming bigger and bigger to stop that for the good of all? How is that going to benefit them in the long run? And I think that's the biggest problem. And that's the one barrier that we need to cross. We need to cross this barrier of countries being countries, and there needs to be more global declarations. And there needs to be more kind of
cooperation,
equal cooperation and equal split of resources between these countries to help each other. And any country that does decide to do drastic measures, for example, reduce a lot of its CO2 emissions, reduce a lot of its, or invest a lot in something else, they can't be made to feel that they're left out compared to other countries. And they can't be made to feel like they've made the wrong decision in the long run. And I think that's what it is.
That's a great point. I mean, it's easy to feel superior when you look at the breakdown of where emissions are happening around the world, and you think, oh, well, in Europe, where we live so sustainably, we have such low carbon footprints, and you think, well, why does China have such a big manufacturing industry? It's because they're producing stuff that we buy, you know, like
that's
and absolutely, there's a very blurry line between what you include in your in your emissions totals, you know, for a particular country. I mean, do you include all the things that you basically outsourced to other countries to produce, and then you bought into your country? Typically, you don't, but that's kind of cheating, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a great point. I really, really appreciate that. So thank you so much, Salim. Is there anything, do you have any social media you want to, you know, tell people, or how can people get in contact with you, anything like that?
I can give you my email, for example. I'm more than happy. I'm always very happy for people to get into contact with me. I like to talk about these things, as you can probably tell by now. And I enjoy talking to people, and I enjoy discussing people with this. So I think, Ross, if you can put my email at the end.
And probably LinkedIn as well is probably a good place as well.
And LinkedIn as well. Yeah, absolutely. If anyone wants to get in touch. Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
And, thanks a lot for having me. This has been really nice.